This is WBAI New York.
Hi, this is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Good morning and welcome to Dream Leapers with Harriet Cole here on WBAI in New York City. That's 99.5 FM, and you can find us everywhere online at WBAI.org. I'm excited today. I'm always excited when I get to be with you guys because, as you know, what we do on Dream Leapers is to interview people who have done what I want you to do, who have accessed and activated their dreams. And as you know, I'm an author. I'm a writer first. I have published to date 7 books, all nonfiction books, all in one way or another to help people live an inspired life. And I'm drawn to writers and authors. And today I have the distinct pleasure of having in studio, whenever the author comes or whenever the guest comes, I'm super excited. In studio, I have Kalisha Buchanan, who is the author of several novels, Solemn, Conception, and Upstate. And she has a brand new novel just hot off the press called Speaking of Summer. And this is a book that her publisher says, and I think it's true, pulls readers into a woman's quest for answers and justice about her sister's disappearance from Harlem, leading to revelations about women's lives in America and the arduous task of survival. Kalisha is such an interesting writer. She goes deep into the research in order to really set the stage for the characters and the character development. I've said to you many times, I am a nonfiction writer. I don't have a clue about writing fiction, but I always ask novelists to explain. So she's going to talk to us about that today. But how I even know Kalisha, because I think connections are so interesting. We met the year that my daughter was born, which is almost 16 years ago, in 2003, when she came as a graduate student to work with me, having just gotten her first book deal. So I've been with her from the beginning, and here she is sitting across from me now. Welcome, Kalisha.
Hi, Harriet.
I'm so glad that you're here, and congratulations on novel number 4.
Thank you so much.
That's awesome.
Thank you, Harriet.
And so let's go back to when we met. Because this, for me, you were about to birth a book. I was about to birth a baby.
Yeah.
And so it's been a minute, right?
Yes.
Tell me about your process and what brought you to New York, because you're not from New York.
No, I'm from a small town in Illinois, but I had gone to Chicago, University of Chicago, and I was an English major. And most, I wanted to read books. Mm-hmm. And I was always writing, but I wasn't quite sure. I didn't think being a writer was a job. Mm. Not.
Now, why is that? What did your parents do?
Oh, my family is very working class, mm-hmm. very, very working class. I'm essentially one of the first to go to college. And people had gone to college, but they lived in other places. And so when I went to school, my thoughts were, I have to be a journalist, author, or not author, a journalist. Like, I have to have a job at the paper. Mm-hmm. Maybe a lawyer, get my PhD.
So not you were aspirational, but not necessarily as being an author.
I didn't think it was a job. When I met writers, I met many beautiful writers at University of Chicago organizing events. So people like Angela Davis, Toni Morrison, Nikki Giovanni.
Well, you had proof.
I had proof you could be a writer, but I just thought Gwendolyn
these
Brooks.
These were all full-time writers.
Gwendolyn Brooks, one of her
last. You met all of these people?
Yes. Gwendolyn Brooks did one of her last appearances for a little small organization called Sister Friends that we had.
And for those who don't know, Gwendolyn Brooks was our poet laureate, America's poet laureate. I don't remember under which president, but African-American poet who, I mean, just for a poet.
First Pulitzer Prize winner,
right,
African-American.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah.
And they were just legends in my mind. Giants, almost gods, goddesses. I didn't think that that was me. Mm. And it wasn't until I started reading more in college and what really brought me to the New School specifically was friends who lived in New York City that I went to college with, and then they went back home. They came back here to the city to work on Wall Street, to get the jobs that people like me were expected to get. You weren't supposed to run off and...
and become a novelist.
Be a writer, a novelist, an artist, no. So they came back to work, and I would come visit them, and I was on the subway, and I just read a book called Push by Sapphire, which is precious as the movie, but the book was Push. And I had just read the book, and I saw on the subway an advertisement for the New School, and it said Sapphire was teaching there. And I just said, I'm going to apply. I would like to work with her. And also a man named Hilton Alls, who's a writer for The New Yorker. And I just would read his articles.
And he's an amazing writer. And first of all, The New Yorker has excellent writing all the time. Mm-hmm. Hilton Alls is an African-American man, and Sapphire, African-American woman. Mm-hmm. So here are contemporaries now who are working as writers and being paid and able to take care of themselves. Mm-hmm. So is this inspiration for you at that point?
Yes, at that point, I said, okay, so this is not just Angela Davis and Sonia. The legends, right. Alice Walker. And I can actually study with these people who are working now today. And that's what prompted my application to the New School.
And what was the program at the New School?
MFA in Creative Writing. Mm-hmm. I was supposed to go to law school and get my PhD.
What did your parents say?
They have always just been proud. They just... they just felt like I would be okay. I'd be a success. Mm-hmm. I was, probably too good at taking care of myself, which is what the book is about, or what comes up often in the book. So they just kind of, they didn't want me to go. They thought New York City was huge, but they supported. Mm-hmm. They supported me. But they knew I wanted to write. Everyone knew that I did write.
So what was the first writing job that you had?
In college, I worked for University of Chicago News, writing little headline things. But I always freelance. I would say I went to the school principal in middle school and said I wanted to start a newspaper.
You did?
Yes, and I did it. And then at the university, they had had a black publication called The Black Light. It was suspended.
And
no one was interested in keeping it up. Okay. And an upperclassman wanted to restart it and found out, oh, that's the writer. Came to me and I said, sure. And we kind of worked and we printed it up ourselves.
And what, where?
At college.
This is now in college.
University of Chicago.
Okay.
Still in college. So I was always writing a lot of for free. But I worked at Essence. I was a temp in the business office, actually. And so
when
I got to see the first year I moved to New York, I was at the Essence offices when the Twin Towers 9/11 happened. And I just come and started school. And I was like, I don't think New York is for me. Because it was literally, I'm working at a place like Essence and I'm seeing the inside of the, the magazine world. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I could do this.
So what does that mean for those who are listening who may not know? What is the inside of the magazine world that you saw?
Well, for us, Essence, it's like the legends, you know. But it is a lot of work. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of details you don't know and see. It was where I learned, oh, the magazine comes out in 3 or 4 months that we have to work on now. So those kind of things.
The deadlines.
Yes, it's much slower than newspaper. Mm-hmm. And so all of that stuff, all of the various protocols, the people. But I have to say, again, a woman like Susan Taylor, I had heard her speak as well. So here's another legend. And you're like, oh, well, I can work with her. You know, it's just all these moments where I felt.
And was Susan still at Essence at that point?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, she would come at my cubicle and just knock and say, hi, how are you? And I just say, hi, because I'm still getting used to seeing people that I grew up reading about or just seeing in media. And it just started to get closer and closer that okay, maybe I can do these things, or I am working out in these zones. I'm not, you know, I'm working out basically and adapting and doing it.
And so when you were at Essence, you said you were in the business office. Mm-hmm. Were you writing there?
No.
Okay, this was a gig.
I was not in editorial, although they would let us go in the closet sometimes. I could go in there sometimes, yeah. So yeah, no, it was just I always wrote to places when I wanted to do something. And I just wrote a letter and said, you know, hi, I'm in New York.
So you were in school at the time?
I was moving here for school.
Okay.
I had to work.
Right.
The new school's program offered evening classes, so that was going to let me work in the daytime. And so I worked at the Gap. That was the first one. And then I called.
Hey, hustle. Yeah. It was real.
It was real. And I called, I wrote to Essence and looked it up. Who do I write to?
So were you trying to get a job in editorial or just a job?
Anything that I could do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, of course, I probably wanted to do books, mm-hmm. The book section. Yeah, the beauty section, the interviews with the people, important people. But they took me, immediately called and was like, we need somebody to come in the business office. Like, so I was like, okay.
And how long was the MFA program at the new school?
2 years.
2 years. Mm-hmm. And so you then spent 2 years right after undergrad immersed in New York City.
Sorry, let me go back.
Okay.
It was 2 years in Chicago realizing I wanted to write.
I see.
For 2 years, I worked in Chicago, which is quite a different city. You know.
Yes, I spent 3 years. I never lived in Chicago, but when I was helping to run Ebony. And running Ebony, I was in Chicago for part of every week, just about. Either New York, Chicago, or New York, LA, depending upon what the work was. Mm-hmm. Very different city. Great city, but very different from New York.
For media, for African Americans in the creative arts. And I didn't see a place for me for what I envisioned doing. And I worked for a great organization. Finally, I did a lot of temping. And I worked at a National Black MBA Association for a while, communications associate. But I just didn't think, I just wanted to do it. I had something in me that I wanted to express. I wanted to say I had tried. So I wanted to say I tried to be like Zora. You know, I tried to be like Langston. I lived in Harlem. I tried to be James Baldwin. And just, I thought it was going to be a story maybe for the grandchildren. So I was going to tell them later, your grandmother went to Harlem and...
I tried. See, that's that verb. For those of you listening, I do not like the verb to try. The reason I don't like it is exactly, you know, what happens is trying is like, I try to pick up the fork, but do you pick it up? It's that way out in a sense. In your case, you did far more than try.
Yeah.
But a lot of times when people say, I'm trying to do something, there's the caveat there that they don't really have to do it, you know? So because it can be scary. It can be scary. But in your case, you did it, right?
I found a way to get to New York City.
It took 2 years, though.
I worked after college for 2 years, and I just was not happy. And I kept visiting. And I had everything. A young woman is told, I think, you should want.
What does that mean?
I had a job after college degree, and it was a nice title. I had an apartment that was pretty budget friendly in a neighborhood like Hyde Park. You know the neighborhood is for Black people. I had a fiance. I had pets. I had a new car. All these things.
And what kind of job was this?
I was the media relations specialist. So
it was in the space a little bit.
Yes. And my job was to get press for the board members of the organization and to support the communications director with all of they put on a huge conference every year that was attended by 13,000 people. So to report out for that conference to try to get media. So I did a lot of work, met a lot of beautiful, important people. I was always meeting, in my life, African-American men and women who had transcended, who had a wide impact. So where people, someone like me would know them and look up mm-hmm. to them. I was just always meeting these people and discovering that their work was important and being around them and helping them and feeling like, well, I can do it too in a way. I can do something on a higher level that reaches more people. So people like Jesse Jackson, Julianne Malveau, economist, great economist, were people, some of the people that I had to help support.
So once again, you were just meeting these trailblazers.
Trailblazers, yes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. History makers,
absolutely.
Yes.
And
I wrote to her as well.
So just for context, you had the life. You had the life that a whole lot of people mm-hmm. wish they would have. The fiance, the animals, the nice apartment, the good job, meeting all these incredible people.
The new Chevy.
The new Chevy. You walked away from all that.
I wanted to write. And when in Chicago, when I'd say I'm writing, I'm going to be a writer, people would think, oh, well, what else do you do? You can't, you know?
Right.
And I thought about it, and I knew my history because I did have a beautiful education in literary scholarship in history. And I knew, I was like, wait a minute, but these people were writers and they wrote their fiction. And so I just needed to get out
in order
where
to have
I was.
A chance. Yeah. Hey guys, we're talking to Kalisha Buchanan. She's telling us about this journey of becoming a writer, and she is now a seasoned author. She's here to talk about her latest book. You're listening to Dream Leapers with Harriet Cole here on WBAI in New York City. That's 99.5 FM and everywhere online at WBAI.org. I want to remind you, because I recently, you know, I always tell you about WBAI.org, but on my smartphone just the other day, I said, I want to listen to WBAI, and I wasn't in my car, which is where I typically listen. I pulled it up on my phone. I was like, oh, I really can listen online. And it was fun to do that. So I encourage you, wherever you are, if you are interested in hearing programming that already has played, you go to the archives. And also, whatever the live programming is, you literally can get it by going to WBAI.org on whatever device you have. So we're talking to Kalisha Buchanan, who worked with me at the beginning when she left Chicago shortly after that and came to New York to begin this journey as a writer. I feel privileged to have known you from those early days. But so as you were pivoting from a very comfortable life that you say you grew up in a working class household. So what you just described is a middle class kind of household that you had created. To walk away from that, to move to New York City, to pursue your dream, had to be scary.
It was, but I was fortunate to have friends who had, I'd gone to college with them, and they were native New Yorkers. Mm. So they had families here. As a matter of fact, I'm with one now in Brooklyn still, you know.
Because you still live in Chicago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or in the Chicago area.
Mm-hmm.
But you sort of are nomadic a bit.
I can't, yes. When I left New York behind, just to go back to family, my creativity stunted. Mm. Yes. So I had to have it back in my life on a regular basis.
So you come to New York. You get the program, the master's program at the new school. In that program, do you have to commit to a particular project that you're going to develop?
They have three sections. Most of the MFA programs do poetry, fiction, and they're developing new areas. Creative nonfiction is one, so that would be memoir, made the things you write, they call it creative nonfiction. And so you have to choose your concentration because that determines the teachers that you take. Mm. and admittance, how many people they let in for the different sections. And fiction is always the one that has the most sections.
Does it?
Yeah, the most students. And
I find that fascinating. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to write fiction.
And fiction is the one that is the eyeball you probably want. Well, poetry, but they don't have as many coming as they do for fiction. So, you know, it's something we all know, people that say, I want to write a book. Actually, I didn't know a lot of people who said that they wanted to write a book until I wrote one. And then I said, well, wow, where were all you people when I wanted to write a book and didn't know what I was doing? Because it was a closet thing. And then, you know, everybody. So, yeah, I mean, everybody writes, I guess. But when I came to the New School, I already had an agent. I had already written a manuscript. Yeah, I was, because I had my jobs, but I was writing at night. I'd get off from my jobs. I would go to the little gym, the YMCA, work out, come home, and I'd be writing.
So you had that commitment early on.
Well, yes. And what happened was I found a big agent writing to the agents. And I had this manuscript that I got great feedback on, but it didn't sell. I was still in Chicago. And it was frustrating because I said, well, I thought it was like 400 pages. I was like, well, I thought when you get the agent, and I thought it sells. And it didn't sell. And most people would have said, well, I still don't know why I continued, because I said, well, I have to do something more now than maybe I have to go to New York. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what it was, the rejection, maybe the disappointment of that thinking, the excitement thinking, wow, I have an agent.
Well, I just interviewed another author who was talking about the 5-year process that it took for her to get her first mm-hmm. novel published. If I think for everyone listening, if you have a dream and you think it's worth pursuing, you have to put in the time. Usually mm-hmm. it takes longer than whatever you think it should take in order for a dream to manifest. And mm-hmm. that, I think that's true for most of us. But if you keep at it and look at the rejections as obstacles, but not as, you know, a slammed door, you know, I think that can be very helpful. So what was your first book?
My first book was my thesis at the New School, which is a dream come true situation. It's something that a lot of young writers who debut young, it was a trend almost, where, because MFA programs, the popularity of them is fairly recent. And so to have your thesis bought by a publisher, which was my homework, this mm-hmm. is called Upstate. And how that came about, I've always been, I'm open to suggestions. mm-hmm. I'm always open to suggestions. I listen to people. I always did. And my teacher, Sapphire, had mentored me and decided to be my advisor for my project, my final project. And I was going to write stories, which is what you do. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what they teach you. And I just had mentioned learning about all the Black men who were in prison and mm-hmm. that there were more Black men in prison ages 18 to 24 than college. And I was distraught. And I was telling her about starting to write these letters between two Black kids, a boy who was gone to jail and his girlfriend left behind. I know where this came from. And Sapphire said, no, write that. Don't write the stories. And I was like, who would want to read some letters between some Black kids? It's not a thing. It's just a thing. It's nothing. Right. You know, it's just something I was doing.
But she saw that in you.
Yes. She said, oh no, when you said that, I just felt something. And I just said, okay, fine. And I started working on it. The more I started working on it, and it wasn't anything that I had seen before. I'd read letters, novels and letters. Mm-hmm. But it was just a very ferocious writing and almost obsession with it that came right after. Almost maybe that I needed some affirmation from someone to say that it wasn't a silly idea.
And to talk about that creative process, because you have the idea. Now, it's been co-signed, so you feel like, oh, okay, okay, maybe I can do this. Mm-hmm. But what happens for you as a writer when you now are inhabiting these mm-hmm. two individuals' lives and minds and finding their voices through this epistolary form?
You know, it's tough. It's nice. I love it. I love the job. It is demanding mentally and spiritually because you want to spend time with them. I've never had a child, mm-hmm. but I almost think it's like that experience where you just want to spend time with your new child. Why would I want to go out? Why do I want to talk to others? I just want to be with my thing.
But did you do research to understand what they might be going through? How did you get to
it? I kind of knew. I knew the world, the life. I was living in Harlem, number one, and at that time, at least in 2002, 2003, I was surrounded by men who had been in jail. They looked out for me on the street.
And so you talked to them?
Oh, yeah. I didn't know how I got the title Upstate for the first novel was the guys would always be talking about, oh, we're going upstate or we're coming from upstate. And I just thought they were going on vacation. I didn't know that they were talking about the penitentiary system upstate.
Wow.
Because in Illinois, it's downstate. And then, of course, I think, you know, all families, I would say my small town is like a Ferguson, Missouri. Mm. It's outside, right outside of Chicago. So it's one of those places. We talk about Chicago. We talk about New York. We talk about L.A., D.C., Atlanta, Houston. But it's the places like Ferguson that these systematic things are happening as well that keep people in small stuff, you know, petty things like the Sandra Bland incident, where these small things wind up taking lives away, maybe not physically, but mentally, possibility-wise. So,
and,
yeah.
And in upstate, as you are exploring the relationship between the young man who's incarcerated and his girlfriend who's left behind, what are some of the themes that you end up exploring?
You know, it was really the love, you know, like the love story. And I look at it sometimes and these kids are so in love and all passionate and it just seems like it's going to last forever. So I was happy to show that side because I was also tired of seeing all the stereotypes mm-hmm. of black children, youth. I think 16, 17 is still children.
Mm-hmm.
And I was tired of seeing this. I wanted, you know, these kids love, you know, they love their families. They love, you know, not just a romantic relationship, but their families, their friends. And so that was there's a lot of fierce love going on in upstate. They're trying to stay together despite all these odds. The family is trying to stay together. The relationship is trying to stay together. The teachers are trying to hold on to the kids. And so that's really was the drive because it was, you know, that was the only way to calm down the anger from the statistic about
sure.
black men in jail.
And how was this first book, which is your thesis, mm-hmm. how was it received?
Immediately, Sapphire said, I'm going to take this to a friend. Because the big time agent wasn't going to do me anymore. Like, I was done. The mm-hmm. big time agent, you don't sell? Okay. So Sapphire said, let's get you with someone smaller.
Right.
I have a friend, you know.
And who you know is so important.
Yeah. Her friend. She just, mm-hmm. they happen to have an African dance class together. Tracy Sherrod, she's the editor.
She worked on my very first book.
Yeah. Yes. Editor, yes. Yeah. And she had switched to agenting.
Mm-hmm.
And is now back to editing.
Mm-hmm.
But she at the time said, I want to be an agency, but, you know, and that's who Sapphire knew and said, I want you to meet her. I want you to meet this young woman.
Yep.
And Tracy called me in a week and was like, do you want to meet? Are you in Harlem? And I was just like, and at the time I had things going on. Because the other thing about you need... you need a tribe as an artist, because I was going through some housing issues. I'd finished school.
Right.
I wasn't a student anymore. My roommate, New York native best friend, had said, I have to move closer to my job. So I was floating, and I had already been rejected in the past. So when I got that call, so to speak, I wasn't into it. I was just like, hey, some things are going on. And she pressured and pushed. I said, just meet. We'll just meet.
Okay, are you all hearing this? Because what she's saying, here's this gift horse, essentially. And you're going, oh, I don't think so. That sometimes we can't hear or think. Hey, guys, we are talking to Kalisha Buchanan, the author of 4 novels. And she's telling us about her journey right now, talking about just, you know, sometimes when things are going on, you can't even see straight. You can't even hear straight. But if people knock hard enough, then you can realize somebody's knocking on the door. You're listening to Dream Leapers with Harriet Cole here on WBAI in New York City. That's 99.5 FM, online everywhere at WBAI.org. So, Kalisha, you end up with Tracy, whom I love. She was there with my very first book, Jumping the Broom, and we've been connected in one way or another over all these years. She has great vision, and she helped you to bring this book to life, right?
Honestly, that's what it was, because it was a mess, obviously. It's a thesis, you know, and they just wanted...
A thesis is not a book yet.
They wanted it done just to show you could complete a project, mm-hmm. and Sapphire done with taking me as far as she could. It was honestly Tracy who, I just said, there's no books, this is not, and she said, no, this is a book. I know how to spot a book.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay. And then, you know, she gave me her resume. So I was like, wait a minute. You did this.
Well, she's very impressive.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, well, wait a minute. And all those books were things like Rose from Concrete, the Tupac book, and Coldest Winter Ever. And I'm like, okay, all these things were very different.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I said, okay, fine. I'll believe you. But she wanted me to work on it. And I had resistance to the things she wanted me to do as an artiste, which broke down. Now I do it. I just do it because it's quicker, and typically people know what they're talking about.
That's
basically.
Right. And Tracy, by the way, is now running Amistad Press, right? So this is, I mean, she's really built her career as well. So mm-hmm. I want to move to the current book, because I want mm-hmm. you to read from this book. Speaking of summer, this is the book that is coming out in time for summer reading, right?
Yeah.
And this book takes you back to New York, right? Mm-hmm. So tell us, what is the book about? And then let's hear you read a little bit of it.
Speaking of summer, I started when I started to come back to New York City and realized I just had to have the city in my life, and I go stay in Harlem. And given some of the things that I had gone through in Chicago with just a small book deal, which is really a start to your career, which you had told me, Harriet, mm-hmm. you told me a lot, you know, I was seen as okay. So many people just said, oh, Kalisha's fine, but you still need that tribe and strength. And a lot of my friends, just black women in general, but I would say black women more in particular. And it just troubled me about that. I didn't feel like there was a lot of support. Women just were carrying a lot. And so that's really kind of was the heart of it. I wanted to capture, I mean, I had a beautiful experience living in New York City, because I had friends and who were like, you know, they introduced me to their families. However, I knew women who didn't have that kind of luck. And
what is the protagonist of this story?
Her name is Autumn Spencer, and so she moves to New York from Chicago. Now, this is not my story, I always have to say, but, you know.
But there's some.
I use the parallels some, right. mm-hmm. to start getting into what I want to talk about, because that's just easiest, you
sure.
know. And so she comes out with these dreams into New York that she's to live with her sister, and she doesn't really know what she's going to do, but she wants to do something more than she's doing in Chicago. And over time, kind of things disintegrate and evaporate for a variety of reasons. I would say most notably, lack of support, lack of steady support, you know, kind of come and go support, maybe. And that's one of the themes of the book is.
So let's read a little bit.
Okay, so this is from the very opening of the book, the opening pages. I was the nice-looking, well-dressed woman running down 150th Street in Harlem after school and before evening rush hour on a bright day at the end of August in 2015. If you saw me with my purse half open and my balance tested more than once, you were wrong to laugh and right to be alarmed. If you saw me trip and bust my lip, you were right. It really did hurt. If you thought I was being chased and you failed to call the police, I thank you for your apathy. We are city folk, hard to shock and minding our own business. I get it. I've been you before. If you were the person who crashed into me on the obstacle course of bodies and bags we wriggle through every day, I didn't want your apology. I didn't let you pick me up. I didn't appreciate your concern. I didn't care you cared. I didn't trust your help. I didn't believe you were safe. If you were the driver of a car that almost clipped me, I wouldn't have let you call me an ambulance if it had been worse. The last place I wanted to see was a hospital. I had enough of those in the past few years. I would have blocked out the pain, pushed past the limp your shiny bumper gave. Maybe you broke my stride, but I kept on. If you had been someone who knew me, I wouldn't have answered to my name. I wanted to forget it. That's why I was running. If you had been one of those block meddlers or self-appointed neighborhood watch folks who just have to investigate, you wouldn't have caught up with me. I knew where I was going. Harlem is my home. I know its corners, curves, and crevices like a palm reader gazing down on it, marking its history and predicting its future. If you got high on my perfume floating in the uptown air, you could have never named the scent. It was a combination of high street, fight, flight, and period coming down on a woman made by another woman who ate Heartland dirt while I formed in her stomach. If you were one of the men who saw me like that, but mostly you drooled over my breast flopping and my behind hopping, I was running from you along with everything else. If you're a woman who saw me like that, but you were busy running too, please know I was running for us all. If you thought about me later and shopped for my face on the internet or the news to see what happened to me, you were disappointed. I was under the radar, off the grid, insignificant, and all alone. I would not have made the news unless I was murdered. And I suspect my headline would have faded quickly, if the fact was even newsworthy at all. Then you would have forgotten me once your curiosity was satisfied to know whatever happened to the nice-looking, well-dressed woman running down 151st Street on a bright day at the end of August in 2015, with her eyes glazed over and her whole truth paused. Nobody was any of these people. That is why I'm telling all this now.
What a setup. And so we go on to, well, you kind of go back and forth because we're learning about this character there as an adult and she's running. You go also even in the beginning of the book to when she's younger. You want to read a part of that?
Sure. This is immediately following the part I just read because, as you said, this story is intertwined, weaved into the past, into all of who this woman is. For you, my little story would have started that day. But for me, it started in my old house back in Illinois, where me and my twin sister Summer and my mama and my grandma lived in a peace I only appreciated after it was gone. A man came along, and suddenly me and Summer had to shine our faces and be quiet and act normal, as Grandma put it. We had to sit upstairs in our bedroom with dolls and storybooks and a 45-inch fairy tale on the record player. We had to wear good shoes and bobby socks with no holes and keep them on so the bottom of our feet didn't get dirty. We had to act like you got some sense, and don't you embarrass us now, you hear me? We had to ma'am and sir and please and may I. We had to keep our elbows off the table and not stuff our mouths. We had to not kick each other by play accident or mock anyone's speech or slurp our juice. We had to eat our vegetables and pick at little pieces of dessert. We had to shunt our personalities into forms less disorienting to men. Murphy's a good man, Grandma said. That's all your mama needs. Soon as she get a good man, she'll quit being so hung up on your daddy. Things will turn around in here. You mark my word. She meant no more pottery smashed to a cement floor in our shed out back. No more neighbors knocking to peer in and whisper, you guys okay? No more feasts 1 week and famines the next. No more hitching familiar passerby for a ride to the bus stop. Since our mother was a crumple of bedhead on the couch and her tart morning breath slurred, have a nice day, girls. No more retrievals way too early from our Catholic school classrooms. No more no-shows to pick us up after school when the others were all gone, so that we must color quietly in the chapel as the confessors straggle in after dark. Mr. Murphy first drove up to our house on Trummel Lane in his black Cadillac, with a hard briefcase and a warm referral from a mother, a woman my mother swam with at the Y. He was a salesman, insurance, life, medical, homeowners. He even sold end-of-life care and premature burial planning at early bird discounts. Cole Murphy, black suit, yellow tie, gold clip, white handkerchief, bald head, centipede long mustache. Everybody knew his face from the State Farm sign at the big barbershop on Court Street, where he arranged an office through a side door. And I also knew his face from the phone book and on the billboard over the junction tracks past the dog food plant we passed to get to the one mall in town. He first rang our house one Sunday after church. I answered the bell. He stayed talking and laughing for a long time. We couldn't take off our tights, so I hated him for the itch. Mama didn't buy a thing from him. Me and Summer and Grandma watched him walk out to his car. He waved before he opened the door. His engine started softly with no struggle. Grandma sucked her teeth and called him slick. She stuck his beige business card on the refrigerator, pinned under a green M alphabet magnet. I remember she laughed and said, Murphy go good with money. Grandma gave him some store German chocolate cake with heavy cream in his coffee that first time and the next time. Mama still brought nothing from him, so he kept coming by in the day with his hard briefcase. Then he showed up at night with flowers shivering in crunchy green paper. Mama left with him in the clothes she wore to church, usually beige leather pumps to match this one camel suede purse. She and this man would be gone for time she normally hung in with us, watching BET videos or Lifetime movies with the Virginia Slims in her hand and rollers in her hair. I missed her pot of Lipton's tea with the full clear bottle next to it. I didn't know what was in the bottle back then. On those nights she left us, Summer and me whined for permission to eat in front of the TV. Once Grandma was snoring, we turned off the lights and pretended to sleep. We were really making silly jokes and impersonations of people we knew under the covers, giggling until we had to go pee or sneak milk. We started waiting later and later to hear Mama's heels slide up the steps, the screen door pull back, and the front porch wind chime sound.
Very detailed. That's what I think is so great about good fiction, when you really take somebody in and they can follow the story so well. Can you tell me about that part of your process, the detail? Because we've talked about this in the past. You know, there are the historical references, there are the neighborhood references, then getting into the head of the characters. All of these stories have to be believable. How do you develop the stories?
The time. You have to put in the time. For me, some people, you know, Zora wrote Their Eyes in 6 weeks. Well, I would say for me, I just keep writing. So then you warm it up. And even if you don't use I don't use it, I still do it. And then I pull out what sounds like the person I'm thinking of. And I keep building it from there. So a lot of things I don't even use. I just write. And then I go back and pull out what to me seems like something that I really see and can work with.
And do you actually do research about the time period and the neighborhoods and things?
I'm not there yet. For my second book I did, because it was I went back deeply into slavery and
which, what's the title of that one?
Conception.
Right.
And World War, turn of the century. I was leaping back in history.
Right.
But I like taking from the life that I have and know. So I know the Midwest.
And what you observe.
Yes, I already know. I know the Midwest. I know the people. I know the milieu. I knew Harlem. I knew. So I'm not there yet. My last book, Solemn, I did do a lot of research because it was family ties that mm-hmm. I didn't grow up with or mm-hmm. know. I visited, but I didn't know the space. And so I did have to dig in a bit more.
When you need to, you do it.
When I need to, right. Mm-hmm. But it's nice when I don't have to, yeah. because then I can just get into the emotions, the feelings, the words, the action, basically.
Hey, guys, we're talking to Kalisha Buchanan. You know how fast this hour goes. We're almost done, but we're talking about, you know, novel writing, really getting into the storytelling, figuring out how to bring a story to life. This is her fourth novel. And for any of you who have tried writing a novel, it is not easy. It's not easy to produce a book of any kind, but when you're building a story, it takes a lot of effort and time. That's what she's talking to us about. You're listening to Dream Leapers with Harriet Cole here on WBAI in New York City. That's 99.5 FM and everywhere online at WBAI.org. So, Kalisha, as we kind of wind down, what advice would you give to people who want to be novelists? What inspiration can you share from your experience?
Have courage. Have courage.
Courage to do what? What do you mean by that?
To walk into experiences that are scary, hard, above the norm, on higher ground. Just go in to it. Because had I not written the agents, mm-hmm. these are big time people.
Sure.
You know, we're all big time in God's eyes. However, in the business sense, write who you want to write. And they answer. Not always. I've been right. rejected. I still get rejected. However, even working for you, I had jumping the broom. I thought I was going to get married. I had the fiance.
Right.
So that disappeared. But I came to the office. I just came. And I'm like, well, I don't know what's going to happen or what. So go in. Is you have to have bravery. I just was never scared to knock on the door.
Well, in relationships.
I was scared. Yeah. I was scared.
Let's talk about relationships, too, because I met you through Sekou, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who did, was he in the same program at the
mm-hmm.
same time?
Yep.
Yeah. So, and
not Sekou, many African men. We were only two.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so Sekou writes, who's been on this program before, ended up working with me for quite some time. And we still collaborate on things over the years. But I bring this up because relationships are key. You know, who you know is almost as important as what you know. Mm-hmm. And I needed help. He was working with me. He referred me to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been blessed to have people share contacts so that I don't have to look out into the great abyss without some support. And I think that mm-hmm. that is very important for all of us. How important have relationships been to your career?
I think extremely. And that's another point of advice, how you treat people.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to come from the Midwest where I didn't have the option to not be polite and
yes.
respectful. It was just was not an option with the women and people I grew up with. However, I came out into the world, and I have to say the majority of Trailblazers history, they're all wonderful, warm people. However, I know many doors opened for me. Even Sapphire said you always came to class. You were nice to everyone. Working with you, I saw it. I saw how it gets you so much further to be calm, understanding, and just give people the benefit of the doubt to a point.
Right.
So I think in relationships, because that's how it worked, no one will refer you. If you've been difficult or if you were rude, or that's a myth. I think it's a myth that the artist or the successful people are rude. How it's too much work. It's too much teamwork. No one would want to work with someone like that.
Well, that is a really good point, and I want to amplify it because a lot of people, particularly the so-called quote unquote artist, believe that they can get away with anything. Well, you know, I'm creative, I'm artistic. But the reality is you have to work with people, and people appreciate folks who do what they say they're going to do and who follow up well. And one thing that you have done, and I've worked with dozens and dozens of young people over the years because I intentionally have interns, and also when I hire people, they're usually young people who are transitioning into something else. So, I mean, there have been so many. Many people don't follow up at all. You, over all these years, I get cards from you. I get calls, not too much, occasionally letting me know what you're doing. When you've come to New York, we've been able to touch base with each other. And I think that counts for a lot, the follow-up.
You know, it was Terry Williams, a woman named...
The personal touch.
You took the words out of right. The personal touch. I interviewed her when I was working for the National Black MBA Association in Chicago and got that book. And that's it. But that's who I was from my upbringing. Mm-hmm. And then as I went on in life, but I think for me, I'm grateful. Mm-hmm. I'm grateful for the impacts people, people might not come out, but I want you to know that I'm grateful. And that's another, I think, tip. Say thank you.
Many people don't do it.
When I said, well, what do I say to all these people? And just say thank you. And I still thank you for everything. Always. But it means something to me personally. It is that personal touch. It's and so I think that's a big, just follow up. Be genuine. Be authentic. And if you don't get on with somebody, that's fine.
But you can still be gracious. So speaking of summer, are you going on a tour?
I will be in New York for a while. I'm still booking dates. We started in 57th Street Books in Chicago, just because it's my college neighborhood bookstore and my home. But I will be at Mysterious Bookshop here in New York City. I will be at Bunch of Grapes, Martha's Vineyard. I hope to talk to you. We'll
during
see.
The summer.
Yes, yes. I was told bookstore. To go there. Yeah. I'll do the St. Louis Book Festival September 21st.
And do you have a website where people can go?
Mm-hmm. www.kalisha.com.
So K-A-L-I-S-H-A. Mm-hmm. Kalisha.com. You can follow Kalisha and find out where she's going to be and when. The new book is Speaking of Summer. Look, as an author, I want you to know we need you to buy our books. So you can buy it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can pre-order, right?
Yes.
You can pre-order now. Authors love being able to get that pre-order. You can go on Amazon or Barnes & Noble for that. Congratulations.
Thank
book
you.
Book number four, you should be very proud.
Thank you so much.
I'm very proud of you. And
thank you.
And thank you for inspiring my listeners, because everybody tells me they want to write a book. It takes a lot to write a book, but when you put your mind to it and you actually do it, it can happen. And you prove to yourself that you can make a living as an author.
Yes, you have to want and surprise, beautiful surprises. But as you said, you're right. I did put in the time and work hard, and that it's time. Can't just say try. You're right. So just work. If you want it, you have to have the faith. I wanted it really bad, so I put that time in.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Hey, guys, it's always good to talk to you and to talk to great guests. And if you would like to support this show, Dream Leapers with Harriet Cole, become my BAI buddy. How you do that is to make a contribution monthly of any amount. You can write to us at, is it givetowbai.org for that? For BAI buddies? Yes. Sean, my engineer, always has the answer, so he's telling me yes. You can write to givetowbai.org to become a BAI buddy. Right in there, it's for Dream Leapers. Give any amount every month, and it helps to keep us on the air, and we really appreciate that. Up next, we have Chris Wendt here of a Sunday morning. Until next week, have a great day, have a great week, and make it count.
don't want nobody else to ever love me. You are my shining star, my guiding light, my love that to see. There's not a minute, hour, day or night that I don't love you. You're at the top of my list, cause I'm always thinking of you. I still remember in the days when I was scared to touch you, how I spent my day dreaming, planning how to say I love you. You must have known that I had feelings deep enough to swim in. That's when you opened up your heart and you told me to come in. Oh, my love, a thousand kisses from you is never enough. I just don't wanna stop. Oh, my love, a million days in your arms is never enough. I just don't wanna stop.
Too much, never too much, never too much, never too much. Grab our hand and help WBAI blossom. To help us create more extraordinary and unforgettable shows, just like you were there for your friend who needed a self-esteem boost before the high school prom, we need you to become a BAI buddy. When you become a BAI buddy, you help us become grounded, stronger, and resilient through these shaky financial times. As a BAI buddy, you can donate any amount of your choosing on a monthly basis. In return, you will receive membership benefits and discounts at local businesses, as well as a signature WBAI tote bag. To become a BAI buddy, or for more information, go to give2wbai.org. Join us today and help our dreams grow.
Hey, what's going on? This is Tito Nieves. I want you all to know that I listen to Con Sabor Latino, Montuneando con Marisol, alternating Sundays from 3 to 6 on WBAI 99.5 FM or WBAI.org. Listen live. Also on archive when I miss the show. You know what I love about this show? They inform me about everything. Who recorded, who sang, who composed. And you know what? Shows like this, they're not around anymore. That's why they've been in existence for 34 years. And you know what? I like it like that all the time.
Be sure to tune in this and every Sunday at 6 p.m. for City Watch. City Watch is a forum for detailed discussion and analysis of social, economic, and political issues affecting New Yorkers. And throughout the month of September, we'll be talking with environmental justice leaders at the city, state, and federal levels about climate change and related environmental issues, including green jobs, the intersection of environmental and criminal justice, and the impact of climate change on communities of color. These conversations are aligned with the UN Climate Summit and Climate Week New York City taking place in September. So be sure to join co-hosts Jeff Simmons, Bick Hafam, and Joel Berg every Sunday at 6 p.m. for City Watch on listener-supported WBAI 99.5 FM New York and streaming live at WBAI.org.
Oh, turn the music back on.
In a minute. First, noble human Homer Simpson will explain his primitive yet beautiful culture.
But perhaps Earth's greatest achievement is moon rocks. Oh, and the golden age of radio.
Ooh.
Truly a species with much to offer.
Seriously? Are we listening to the same guy?
Yes, another unsolicited celebrity endorsement for the golden age of radio. Join me, Max Schmid, for the best of radio's history. Comedies, mysteries, you name it, we'll have it. Programs you may remember, if you're over 80, and programs that you've never heard of before. All fascinating stuff. Sunday nights, 7 to 9, right here on WBAI New York.
Hello.
This is Mike Pinder, co-founder of the Moody Blues. You're listening to WBAI, New York.